That's music from Bob Bennett. It may not have been December. In fact, Doug Greenwald has taught us about that in past Advent programs. Doug, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Doug, the
good to see you again.
Good to see you. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times, based in Columbia, Maryland, where it's rather damp this morning, eh?
Well, we're into our third day of dampness here.
3 days.
That's fine by me. Mm-hmm. I threw some fertilizer into the shrubs the other day, and so this is will be a good soaking in for the winter.
Okay. Well, making hay while the sun doesn't shine, so to speak.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, we got snow here. It is a winter wonderland outside, but it's not serious winter yet. It's still much too warm. We're looking at 30s and maybe 40 tomorrow. So we're experiencing you've got global wetness there, and we've got global snowness over here.
Well, we also have another phenomenon going on here that's it's sort of symbolizes Washington D.C. for some. Mm-hmm. Our Washington Redskins are tied for first place in the NFL East with a losing record.
David was talking.
Isn't that typify Washington, D.C.? We think we're winners, but we're really losing?
Yeah. Well, the key in that division is to lose nicer than the other guys lose, I suppose.
Lose in the right places.
Yeah, lose at the right time. Doug, you've got Preserving Bible Times is a busy ministry because you do tours to Israel once a year, twice a year. Do you go to Israel?
Israel is an annual event.
Okay, once a year, and you've added Italy tours, kind of Pauline study tours. So you're going to Italy, and of course you travel all over the country. And December, a busy month for you. You're visiting churches around the country this month. And with your Bible Alive weekends and your Advent series, and what else is going on? What's new? What's coming up?
Well, since we have our Life and Land of Jesus contextual immersion trip pretty well in place for Israel, and next year in late April will be our fourth trip to Italy. We've pretty much got Paul's Roman world put to bed and where we like it. And so we wanted to expand our portfolio of contextual immersion experiences, and the Apostle John seemed to be next on the horizon here. And so we put together a trip called Walking with the Apostle John for next October, October 1 to 11, in which we will be in Western Turkey.
Ephesus.
Ephesus and Pergamon and the other five churches of the seven churches of the Revelation, as well as Istanbul and a couple of other stops. And it was getting all of this pulled together. Going to see the seven churches of the Revelation is a pretty straightforward thing to do. Mm-hmm. But I wanted this to have very much of a devotional emphasis, this trip. So it took some time to work on that. And I always like to have unique cultural experiences, so we're going to spend one day in a large villa operation out in the countryside in Turkey, getting exposed to Turkish cooking, Turkish food, Turkish village life, Turkish folklore, Turkish culture. We're going to spend some time in a Turkish bath. We're going to spend some time on the Turkish Riviera, and so it was getting all those pieces together. That's sort of the ambiance part, but the focus here is John was the last surviving of the original apostles, disciples. And at the end of John's life, the Roman Empire is really in its golden age. And so there's a sense of stability that's now in place that wasn't in place, say, 50 years earlier. And the issues now that these young churches are facing are different. And so I think we're going to really enjoy exploring the Gospel of John and 1st and 2nd and 3rd John, his teachings in context as well. And since we're in that part of the country, I also wanted to overlay some other things, such as the history of the Eastern Roman Empire and the development and teachings from the church councils of Asia Minor. And also the progression of how Roman Constantinople became Istanbul. So that's what we're sort of been putting together for the last year. And anyway, we're announcing it this week. So,
well, I have a question for you.
That's what's new.
In talking about the Italian trips, one of the points you made was that there's so much intact, so many preserved dwellings, buildings, streets, places in Italy that were much like they were in the first century. You can still see and get a very good feel for what life was like in the first century. But you contrasted that with Israel, where there's so much rubble, old stuff that's basically a pile of rocks. And you go and you reveal the history, things that happened there, but it's not the same feel because the buildings aren't all standing. What do you find in Turkey? Have they preserved their history well in Turkey?
Well, in Pergamon and Ephesus, you have two world-class archaeological sites. The scope of Ephesus is beyond anything that you will find either in Rome or in Israel. But there's also a difference here. This trip is trying to understand the issues of the early church, and particularly the pastoral issues, and then we want to convert that all into today's journey of faith issues. And so that's a different emphasis. We're not so much, we'll be at the places where the rocks are, but the rocks are not our focus. The focus is going to be what were the issues in that particular church, how did John address them, and what are the implications today, and then take a devotional perspective on what does that mean to me today. So it's a very different emphasis trip than, say, even our Pauline trip to Italy is, where we're much more concerned about Roman culture. Now that we understand Roman culture, we want to understand how it impacted the church that John was the bishop of, all of his churches in those seven churches of the Revelation. So your observation is true, but it also, that's not going to be our emphasis. Okay. It's going to be much more pastoral, much more church history oriented.
Sounds fascinating to me, because the interaction between Rome and Constantinople was really key to the development of the church, particularly through the 4th century. And there'd be a lot of history there. And, of course, we love history. We love learning. And that's why having you is such a treat for us every Wednesday morning. We're deep. I think we're deep. It depends on how many parts there are to this story. But the parable of the prodigal sons. Seven weeks now we've been dealing with this, and we're learning a lot, and we've learned that the focus is has a lot to do with that older sibling, the older son. And I'm still waiting to get to the part about the father, because so many sermons and churches around these parts focus on the father. He's symbolic of God the Father, of course, and we see how he reacts. But what we don't seem to see is the sense of community that's talked about in that series of three parables that Jesus was telling. He was there for a reason. He had a specific audience, a specific objective in mind, and he did it so well. Where next in the parable?
Well, we are going to start to immerse ourselves in the Father, the Father's heart, the Father's paradigm of forgiveness and restoration today. But since we've got six episodes, so to speak, under our belt, let me do with you what I often do with seminar groups and conference groups around the country at different points in time of a teaching weekend. Just pause and say, give me some feedback with one, two, or three word phrases that encapsulate part of the way you've responded to where we've been so far. Okay? So let me throw the mic in your direction and sort, you know, even stream of consciousness, just short phrases, words that encapsulate part of the way you've responded to, reacted to the material so far that we've developed.
I think prodigal is the wrong word to apply in its true meaning. I see sibling conflict as a central theme to this, and how to elevate that to a spiritual level I'm still looking for. You know, what's the spiritual component of the older and the younger son in their opposition? But it's apparent that that's a key matter in this whole story. And Jesus' dexterity in pulling the rug out from under the Pharisees in this thing, it was just with the opening. I marvel at that every time, how he can be so nice and so deadly at the same time.
He is the master storyteller, as well as being the story himself. Mm-hmm.
David,
why do you think it's the wrong word?
Well, prodigal talks about spending. And as we've covered the past couple of weeks, this wasn't so much about the money he wasted as the lessons he learned. And it's reprobate. There's got to be a better word than prodigal, which is extravagant spending here. And we don't know that he did that. That was the older brother's view of things.
Doug, do you know where the word prodigal came from?
I don't, but I want to spring off Jim's observation here of excessive. Certainly, he was excessive in his demands of his father. He was excessive in the way he squandered his fortune. The way the elder brother reacted was excessive. The degree to which the father allowed the son to have his inheritance and leave home was excessive. And now we're about to see excessiveness represent itself in forgiveness and compassion. Mm-hmm. So if the word prodigal contains the word excessive, as Tim Keller developed in his book, The Prodigal God, the excessive God, excessive compassion, excessive grace, excessive mercy, it's a good word. I think we typically constrain the word prodigal to mean wandering away or, you know, something along that lines. But if you just take the excessiveness piece of that, it applies to almost everything we're running across in this parable. Every reaction is excessive.
Now, maybe it's just my understanding, but I find it fascinating that this parable is so well known and so commonly preached and included in sermons and books and analyzed, that it's actually had a bearing on how we understand the word prodigal.
It is. And, you know, even in the church, when there's a family that has a child, could be either son or daughter, sometimes you hear the phrase, well, they're off in a phase of their life where they're sowing wild oats. Mm-hmm. You ever heard that one?
Yeah.
That's what we mean by prodigal.
Okay.
That's what we've come to mean by prodigal. Mm-hmm. One who has drifted away and is doing excessive bad things.
Yeah.
And so that's a very narrow definition. But once again, it does conjure up this notion of excessive departure from accepted norms. And that's certainly at work here in this parable. Jesus is challenging the norms of forgiveness, the norms of restoration, the norms of retribution in the theological mind of his Pharisaic, rabbinic thinking people in the audience.
So the son comes home.
And the son is on the way home.
Yeah, okay.
We talked about that last week. What, mm-hmm. what causes a person to come to their senses? As he goes home, he gins up a game plan. He's practicing his speech. You know, I've sinned. I'm not worthy to be your son. Let me live off campus and be a hired hand. He's, let's say, within a mile of actually coming home now. And oftentimes, there's a tendency to flinch just before we're about to execute what we thought we were going to do. So if he had a 20-mile walk home, the real resolve has to kick in at the 19th mile to actually go through now as you get close to the end of what you were planning to do. So I think that dynamic is there. And as the younger son gets ready to come home to his senses, the Pharisees in the audience would have assumed how the father was going to react. Okay? Obviously, the father is not going to embrace his son. Obviously, he's not going to be gracious and merciful. And so they would expect the father to say something like this to this returning younger son, if and when the younger son actually shows up in the village. For example, their paradigm of forgiveness, of retribution, would be something like this. They would expect the father to say, you know, there are limits to my grace, and you've exceeded them. There are boundaries to my mercies, and you've crossed them. Please leave now, and don't ever darken my doorway again. That's what they would expect. That's what a typical father would do in that culture, because the family has been shamed, the village has been shamed, and it's amazing he didn't get stoned to death before he even left the village, but given that he didn't, he'll probably be stoned now, but at a minimum, he would never be allowed back into the household, okay? Or here's another version of how the Pharisaic paradigm would have thought the father should respond. For religious and cultural reasons, my son, I've decided to shun you for the way you have humiliated and disgraced me. You have forfeited your sonship forever. Get out of my sight. Okay? They said, yeah, that's what fathers do. That's what fathers should do. That's the proper thing to do. That's the paradigm in which they think. Or, corollary number three here. The father would say to this returning son, you know, son, maintaining my reputation in the community and in the clan is far more important to me than being reconciled with you, you wayward son. Be gone by sundown, or I will have the village stone you. Okay? That's how the Pharisees would have thought. Or one more here. I've waited and I've waited and I've waited for you to come home, and I've waited long enough. I'm sorry you took so long to come to your senses, but it's too late. I have run out of patience with you. Okay? Can you relate to the Pharisees thinking that way?
Yeah, I can. But I'm also trying to be in the mind of the younger son. He didn't know what to expect, or did he? Did he expect that kind of treatment himself? Because that was the cultural norm.
He does not know what to expect. Hmm. But he does know his father. I mean, he's lived with him for 30 years. Okay? I would suggest he does know his father's heart, and that's what's bringing him home. Mm-hmm. Now, what terms and conditions might his father come up with to surround his coming home? That's the uncertainty. That's the unknown. Because think about you and I. As much as we talk about unlimited grace, we really, I think, have notions of grace that's conditional. Yes, I will be merciful if you will do this. Yes, I'll be gracious if you respond this way and act that way. Okay? There's a lot of what we do is conditionalized grace and mercy. And we're about to find out this father puts no conditions on his grace and his mercy when a wayward son, a wayward child comes home.
That is so hard to get used to, even from our perspective in today's culture in the West here, because you have to earn that stuff.
Absolutely.
And if you get it, you have to repay it somehow. You know, you're indebted when a favor, when a great favor is done for you.
And, oh, that reminds me of something I recently read. This is an insert. But St. James, who wrote the Latin Vulgate Bible, mm-hmm. By looking at the Septuagint as well as the Hebrew Old Testament text, and came up with the Latin Bible, the first linguist, really, of the Bible, and did this in Bethlehem in a cave in probably the late 300s. When he came to the word repent, okay, he translated it, do penance.
Yeah.
And that's where we get this notion of conditional grace, okay? Mm-hmm. You got to do some penance to get back in favor, so to speak, to pay off the debt that's accumulated. And so the whole penance system that evolved in the historic Catholic Church, you know, is traceable to Jerome translating the underlying Greek word for repent mm-hmm. into do penance. But I do think that ties to what you just responded to here. That is our natural reaction, isn't it? You got to do penance somehow to make amends for the grace and mercy that will be extended to you or was extended to you. You got to earn it. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is just going to blow that paradigm to smithereens. Why is that important? Because disciples are those people, those followers who emulate their rabbi perfectly in all ways. And so if this is Jesus's paradigm of forgiveness, of acceptance, of reconciliation, this is what he expects his disciples to do. This is what should be going on in our churches today. Well, there's another response, probably a stretch response that the Pharisees might have anticipated. It would go something like this. Okay, you wayward son, you can stay here for a while, but only on my terms. You can stay in your room for 90 days with one meal a day because I want you to stew in your own juices and think about the terrible and scandalous things you have done. Furthermore, you will be on probation for the next 5 years, which will give you ample time to prove to me that you are still worthy of my love. After that, we'll reevaluate your future. After what you've done to me, I'm in no hurry to accept you back, let alone to restore you to sonship. Do you see what's going on in that created response?
Authority is a big deal with those Pharisees.
Yeah, and this is heavily conditional, okay?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
This is a long road of earning your way back into good graces, should we say. Mm-hmm. And the question I have is, implicitly, do we ever operate in the church this way? Let's assume that someone has been adulterous, okay? And they come to their senses, and they walk back in the church, and they confess it. How do we view them for the next 10 years?
Stained.
Yep. Permanently stained, mm-hmm. right? That even though they've come back, they've forfeited any chance for church leadership, right?
Mm-hmm. They're now second-class citizens.
Absolutely. Yeah. Second-class citizens. That's a good way to put it. And that's an interesting book title right there, isn't it? No second-class mm-hmm. citizens in the kingdom of God.
Yeah, I like the idea. And I'm thinking back to a pastor here in the local area. Now, this was 20 years ago. And it was the first church we attended when we came here. And we knew Jack well and loved him. And he came and helped us and welcomed us to the community. But I heard from a lady in her late 20s several years later after we'd stopped attending the church. And she had gone to that church for a long time. And she was about to get married for the second time. And she went to her home church. And Jack, the pastor there, refused to marry her because she had been divorced. Now, this is a Protestant church. And it just floored me that just didn't seem to be in the character of this man I knew to be the pastor. But that so riled him that she had been once married and divorced that she was essentially an outcast from that point on with that church. And it was a sad, sad thing to see.
Yeah, that I understand that reaction. But I remember a pastor who once said this to me. We will do everything we can to keep a family from breaking up, mm-hmm. divorcing. Mm. But if there's a second marriage, we will do everything in our power to make sure it's the best marriage possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the Jewish way of thinking, you sometimes have to do two things at the same time that seem juxtaposed. Mm-hmm. That's why the Jewish mind is very comfortable with paradox. The Western mind can't deal with paradox. When we read the scriptures, we are reading a Jewish mind here. I don't want to go down that rabbit trail, or mm-hmm. it actually could be a substantial cul-de-sac. But the challenge is, how do we respond in grace and in mercy to people who've blown it in our church fellowships when they genuinely, repentantly return? Okay, that's part of what's going on here. And so, as the younger son is walking on the trail and was in a mile or a kilometer of finally getting home, these are some of the scenarios he might be wondering about in his mind about how his father will receive him. But yet at the same time, he knows his father's heart because he lived with him for decades. And so there's this level of uncertainty. And will I go through with my game plan? Will I actually walk into the boundaries of the village? Do I really dare to do that now that I've walked 19 of the 20 miles to get home? I think that's some of the dynamics going on. And, of course, his father understands these kinds of thoughts.
And will I be dead in an hour? I mean, that was a possibility for him, too.
It is if the village gets to him before the father does. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we don't know that the village would stone him, but you have to accept that this is a reasonable outcome that he would entertain in his mind. And so that's part of what's going on, I would suggest, in the emotions, in the heart of this returning younger son. And so now Jesus, once again, the master storyteller, continues to unfold this compelling, gripping, I got you on the edge of your seat story. And he stuns the scribes and the Pharisees in his audience with this. Now from Luke. And while he was yet a long way away, his father saw him. What does that say about the father?
He says he was looking for him.
He's been looking for him every day. Hmm. You don't see somebody afar off unless you've been intentionally looking. Is this our view of the Father when we've blown it? Every day he's looking on the horizon line to see, is this the day we're coming home? And his father saw him and was moved with compassion. And having run... Some translators say the underlying Greek word here can be raced, okay? And having raced to him, he fell on his neck and tenderly kissed him again and again. That's from Kenneth Wiest. Let me read from the Schoenfeld translation. But while he was still a good way off, his father saw him and yearning with pity, ran and threw himself on his neck and kissed him. Okay? So three things here this father does. He sees, he pities, he has compassion, and he runs, he hugs, and he kisses. And to the Pharisaic mind, the Pharisaic worldview, this, on the Richter scale of inconceivable compassion, this is off the charts. Can you get a sense of how stunning what Jesus just said is?
Yes, I am, and I can. And I'm curious to know about this phrase, fell on the neck. Now, it may be just, you know, that's not a phrase I would ever use, and I'm suspecting it's cultural, it's Hebrew, and I'm aware that they had different ideas of what various parts of the body stood for, kind of embodied, and the neck was particularly important. It was essentially the heart, the soul, the personality of the person was kind of located there. So I mean, just choosing the word neck may have been intentional or might have been a translation thing. I'm not sure, but I'm wondering if you have some insights there for that.
I do not. It's an interesting thought. And as I've observed many times before, there's no bottom to these parables. There's mm-hmm. always something more to dig into, and maybe this is the next one I need to dig into. Mm-hmm. But I will observe, as Jewish people, there are lots of facial hair.
Yeah.
And so kissing him on the cheek, you know, maybe doesn't work in that sense. Maybe there's a portion of the neck that
well,
is
it could have
more
been
bare
meant,
skin.
Meant they were close and it was like a hug, but I'm just wondering because yeah. they used the word neck, which to me is kind of unusual.
I think the more significant thing is the kiss, not the neck. But I don't want to get away from this thought here. Mm-hmm. Is this amazing grace or what?
Mm-hmm. Well, it would be astounding, certainly, to his audience.
It's off the charts. It's unthinkable.
And encouraging, revelatory, too, to the tax collectors and sinners that were in his audience. And I believe this was all happening at the meal in Capernaum. Or at least north of Jerusalem someplace, where he had been invited by the tax collectors, by Matthew. Is that accurate?
Well, that's a whole nother situation where he gets deliberately humiliated by his host.
Okay, that's another story. But I was just reading the other day about the parable of the prodigal son, and they had pinpointed it at the feast or the meal held for Jesus by the tax collectors, and that surprised me because I wasn't aware of that. Is that wrong?
I don't know. I'll have to dig into that.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, it does say there were tax collectors and sinners in the audience, so they must have found that equally surprising, but in a positive way.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, there are tax collectors and sinners in the audience. Mm-hmm. Whether it was at a tax collector's home is the thing that I would want to dig into.
I'm not sure.
But we certainly have both ends of the spectrum here. Mm-hmm. The scribes and the Pharisees on one end with their super righteousness, and the technical word for sinners here is those people we know God doesn't like. And obviously, a tax collector is one of those kinds of people.
And how odd it seems to me, and this might be an aside, but I think it's worth looking at, that there was such a disparate, such a divided kind of an audience. You know, normally a teacher goes to his target audience.
I would suggest that it's the perfect audience because Jesus is saying to the Pharisees, you see the people on the other side of the trail here who are listening to me? You need to view them differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's got the perfect audience with the younger brother and the younger brother. Each of the group of two who are watching him can identify with one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's the story of how the two should interact, how the two should relate, because disciples emulate their rabbi. And, you know, the father is the rabbi in this situation. You need to emulate what he does. But anyway, it brings to mind John 1:16, where John has this wonderful phrase, grace upon grace.
Mm-hmm.
This certainly is compassion beyond compassion here. And so, is this our view of God? Back to the theme we raised last week, the most important thing about us is simply this, what comes to our mind when we think about God. Is this our view of God when we've blown it, when we've messed up? Is this our view of God when we've sinned yet again today? Or do we have a view of God that's this conditional grace, conditional mercy, much like the Pharisees did? That's why Jesus is developing this story. He's trying to change their view of God of these Pharisees, and at the same time, challenging our view of God today.
I'm thinking about, in my opinion at least, how the Western Church has failed to pick up that theme and develop it. Because to me, growing up in a Methodist church, God was still a disciplinarian first.
Yes.
Dispense judgment.
For
penalty.
Many, a person I've run across who's been raised in the Roman Catholic schools when the nuns had their rulers and mm-hmm. whacked you over the knuckles,
yeah.
that is their view of God.
Mm-hmm.
Sad. But the key, we probably don't have time to unpack now what happens next, but let's just deal with one aspect of it and then we'll continue on next week. The father raced to embrace his returning son. Okay? Now, in this culture, the more important you are, the slower you walk. Okay. And secondly, to race or to run fast, you have to lift up part of your clothes so, you know, you don't trip and fall, and you expose your ankles, maybe even your lower leg. And to expose any part of your skin in this culture is shameful. Okay? This father is willing to be shamed in the eyes of the community to make sure he delivers the message of restoration, not just to his son, but to the village as well. Because once the village sees how this father is willing to humiliate himself to restore his returning son, they're not going to get carried away with this idea that maybe they need to stone him. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so part of this racing is interventional for two reasons. it sends a message to the son who may be, you know, about to flinch. Do I dare take the last 100 yards and go home? Or shall I just turn around and go back from where I came? And his father said, no, I'm not going to let you flinch. I'm going to run out and greet you. And my running will deliver to you the message that I want you desperately to come home. Please don't turn around and walk away. And at the same time, he's communicating to the village, don't you dare mess with my son from a punitive point of view. I love him so much, I'm willing to be humiliated in my eyes. And Kenneth Bailey suggests this. If a very wealthy man in the village starts to run, it's such a stunning event that the village will probably start to trail him to find out why is he running. And so that allows the father to make a public statement in the eyes of the village when he kisses, when he hugs his returning son.
Well, again, it's contextual. It's so interesting to understand how Jesus' audience would have seen, would have had formed their own mental pictures in listening to this story, and how different those pictures are from what I've always learned.
Yeah, and the application here, which there are many, are we willing to be humiliated to restore someone else back into fellowship in mm-hmm. the body of Christ? Mm-hmm. Or are we concerned about our reputation or the way things might look? Mm.
Good.
This father is willing to be humiliated in the pursuit, in the quest for forgiveness, compassion, and restoration.
We're talking with Doug Greenwald, Executive Director and Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, and I'd like to invite you to visit their website. In fact, Doug, you can sign up for the tours there, can't you, on the website?
You can, as well as our monthly reflections.
Okay. PreservingBibleTimes.org, and you can link to it from our website on Broken Road Radio, and I hope you will, because it's a beautiful website, for one thing, and also chock full of aha moments for you, whether it's DVDs or books or Doug's monthly newsletter that he calls Reflections. That comes to you via email. Doesn't cost a penny. It will light up your life every month. You will look forward to it. And Doug, we'll look forward to next Wednesday. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Guy, and have a wonderful day living in his unconditional grace.
We'll do that. We'll do that. Bye-bye.
See you, Doug.
Shalom.
Shalom, Doug.